Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can you remember? What are you afraid you might forget? And how much of it is within your control? Understanding of where memories are stored in the brain and how we're able to call them back up when we need them has come a long way in recent decades. And some of the most valuable research has been conducted on people at the extremes of memory ability, those who can recall minute details from events long past or impossibly long lists of information, and even those whose damaged brains can't remember anything for longer than it takes for the next thought to drift in. Although some people seem to come by these gifts and limitations naturally, others find that just a modest amount of daily practice can train their minds to memorize amazing amounts of information. Joshua Four is the 2006 USA Memory Champion, and he wrote a cover story on memory and its limitations for this month's National Geographic magazine. He's working on a book about the art and science of memory that will be published in 2009. Josh, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what's the benefit of studying people who have extreme memory abilities or disabilities as opposed to working only with people who are what we would call normal?
Well, I mean, sometimes you have to look at things, I guess, when they're not working in order to figure out how things are supposed to work in the same way that, you know, if you realize all of a sudden that you couldn't watch a channel on your television, you'd probably figure out a lot about how your television worked. I'm not sure if that's a great metaphor, but that's sort of how a lot of what we know about memory and about the brain has happened.
So one of the people whose damaged brain has been heavily studied is a guy known in the literature as EP. What abilities did he lose when his brain was damaged?
Sure. So he had a basically viral encephalitis. A virus essentially chewed its way through part of his brain, the medial temporal lobes, and especially the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that we now know helps turn our perceptions into long-term memories. And so when this happened, it sort of felt like a common sickness. But a couple days later, he realized, or his wife realized, that he was both no longer capable of forming new memories, but also no longer able to remember huge chunks of his past.
What are his days like now? Because he does try to take in information.
So... He, if you can imagine, is a pretty sedentary guy. I mean, he has no past to dwell on, no future to think about. And so he lives his life sort of sitting in his chair and happily passing the time. It's, you know, the ignorance is bliss. He doesn't really get upset about things. It's sort of he has no sense of time, no sense of his place in sort of the passage of time.
And I guess he doesn't even really understand that he's different from everyone else.
This is really remarkable. I went to San Diego to interview him, and we were sitting at his dining room table, and I saw he was wearing a metal bracelet, a medical bracelet, and I said to him, you know, oh, well, what's that for? Of course, I knew what it was for. And he sort of turned it over, and he looked at it, and he said, it says memory loss. He's not even aware that he has a problem.
But what's amazing, because I think so many of us associate memory with intelligence, at least as a major component, he still has a pretty high IQ.
Right. In fact, there's really, except for the parts of the IQ test that test memory, you would have no way of knowing that there was something wrong with him. I mean, the first couple minutes I was talking with him, I assumed he was, or he sort of came across as your average genial grandfather. And when you ask him common sense questions, there's clearly no damage to his common sense. It's only when you start asking him questions that have to do with either his past or with his recollection of facts. I mean, he doesn't even know that the moon landing happened, but he's in his 80s.
Does he recognize his image in the mirror?
Well, he does, but, you know, he doesn't really have a sense of how old he is. So if you ask him how old he is, you know, he might say he's about 60 years old, 50 years old. He says, I just can't remember, which is really remarkable because, you know, it's about a quarter of a century off.
And what's really interesting is that he has proven that there is a difference between physical memory and mental memory, because he is gaining, he can gain some skills in terms of physical skills.
Well, yeah, the distinction that psychologists would make is between declarative memory and non-declarative memory. Also, sometimes you'll hear it referred to as implicit memory and explicit memory. Basically, there are these two different kinds of memory. One is your memory for the memories that you know you have. For example, I know that I remember the color of my car, or I know that I remember my fourth birthday when the candles on my cake set off the smoke detector. Then those are explicit or declarative memories. Then you also have these non-declarative memories, the things that you know but you don't really know you know, like how to ride a bike. And those are the things that one of the things that scientists have learned actually through cases like EP of sort of terrible brain damage is that these different kinds of memories are stored in different parts of the brain. And so you can have damage to one kind of memory and not have damage to the other. In EP's case, he can actually learn things. He just doesn't know that he's learning them. So he will take a walk, for example, around his neighborhood several times a day. And you might think, you know, this is crazy for his wife to let him out of the house. He doesn't know what street he's on. He doesn't know what city he lives in. He doesn't even know, and this is pretty incredible for somebody who lives in San Diego, which way the ocean is. And yet he can take these walks around his neighborhood because he's learned them by habit. And I would ask him, well, why are you turning right here? And he would say, I don't know. I guess I just want to go right. But he doesn't have any understanding that he knows that.
Well, and what's really interesting about that revelation is that it goes back really thousands of years to Simonides and his understanding that humans can remember places, in some cases, better than anything else.
Right. So Simonides was a Greek poet of the 5th century B.C., who is credited, probably given more credit than he deserves, for having invented this technique called the art of memory, which was about inventing a way of remembering more things more easily. And he used it to remember his poems, but it became sort of a technique popular throughout the classic world in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome, and used by orators to remember speeches, by medieval scholars to remember, you know, libraries of books. And basically what he discovered is that our brains are very good at remembering both places and images. And if you can convert something that you want to remember into an image and deposit it in what's called a memory palace, essentially an architectural space that you've imagined in your mind, you can actually remember a whole lot more than you would think would be possible.
I want to talk some more about all of those techniques in a few more minutes, but I want to get back just for a little bit to EP. Is it strange, Josh, when you first start spending time with someone like this, even if you read all the literature and you sort of know what to expect, does it take a while for it to sink in for you that he's not going to remember a minute from now what you've just talked about?
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. So he, for example, is a big fan of National Geographic magazine, which I didn't know when I was going to interview him. He has, I think, every copy going back a long ways. And I would say to him, do you remember why I'm here? And he would say, well, you know, it's kind of slipping my mind at the moment. Why are you here? I said, well, I'm, you know, writing this article for National Geographic magazine about you. And he said, National Geographic magazine, that's incredible. And then 2 minutes later, I would ask him again if he remembered why I was there, and he would say, no, I'm writing this article for National Geographic magazine. National Geographic magazine, that's incredible. And, you know, this would go on and on and on because he had just no recollection of the conversation we'd had 2 minutes ago.
So that was probably a nice little ego boost for you. But it's got to be frustrating for his loved ones. Is he still lives at home with his wife?
Yeah, he lives at home with his wife. He's got a daughter who lives nearby. And it's I think it's a big challenge. You know, for example, he will have breakfast sometimes three times in the morning because he doesn't remember that he just had breakfast. There's no continuity in his life. He only has these moments of time in which he's living.
Is there any sense through the research, maybe not for EP specifically, but that we'll find a way to recover memories that seem to have been lost?
recover memories that seem to have been lost. Well, we all recover memories that seem to have been lost, and it happens all the time. I mean, I just this morning remembered something about my childhood that I had probably not thought about in, you know, 2 decades. The question is, how does that happen and why does it happen? Clearly, we have memories that are socked away somewhere that we're able to recover with just the right cue, whether it's the right smell or the right taste or whatever it is. But I think there are also memories that are actually gone, that have just disappeared from disuse. And it's hard to know which memories are there but inaccessible and which memories are just totally gone.
How does scientists define memory in the first place? Is it much different from the way you and I think about memory?
Well, it depends on what kind of scientist you talk to. I mean, if you ask a neuroscientist, they would give you an answer that says that, you know, memory is sort of the a pattern of connections among neurons in your brain that are represent some phenomenon. If you ask a psychologist, they wouldn't be as interested in the neurological definition of a memory, but would talk probably about how there are several different kinds of memory, and how even talking about memory is, you know, it's not some single monolithic thing. There are these different kinds of memory which happen in different parts of the brain. But I think, you know, you or I would know what a memory is pretty well. It's how we think about the past, and it's our representations of the past in our brain.
So, what brain structures are called into play to have memories? Where do they reside, and how do they get called back up again?
Well, what we know from EP, and there was another patient with a very, very similar set of anatomical problems in the brain named HM, who a lot of this was initially learned from, and this is in the 50s and 60s, that there is a part of the brain in the medial temporal lobe. It's the hippocampus and several of the surrounding structures that take the phenomenon that we are seeing, that we are smelling, or that we are hearing, and somehow converts those into long-term memories. How that actually happens is not fully understood, but the memories don't reside in the hippocampus. They seem to reside elsewhere in the brain, in the neocortex. But the hippocampus somehow plays that role of transforming what is temporary into what is permanent.
We know about short-term memory and long-term memory. Is there such a thing as medium-term memory?
Yeah, I mean, that's a term that psychologists use, but I think just as a way of thinking about this in the simplest terms, you know, you can think about you have a working memory, a short-term memory that essentially holds things as long as you're thinking about them. It's the scratch pad that your brain uses to think. And then you can think about a long-term memory, which is something that's been sort of stored away in a more permanent fashion.
And the triggers you talked earlier about scent or about, you know, something else, I'm curious about the memories that seem to be triggered by other thoughts. Are they different in some way than things that are triggered by some external factor?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about, say, EP is that he does have some memories from his past. He remembers things that are, for example, previous to about 1950, 1960, he has pretty good memory. He remembers World War II, his service in the Merchant Marines. Why is it that he has these memories of the distant past but not memories of the nearer past? And this is true, actually, of all amnesics, that you have this kind of pattern. And it's one thought is that basically older memories somehow take on a different character, that the more you think about them, you're actually changing them in some way or making them more permanent. But how that actually happens is not fully known.
We will return to our discussion in just a moment with my guest, Joshua Foer. He's the 2006 USA Memory Champion, and he wrote the cover story on memory for National Geographic this month. After the break, we will talk about a woman who remembers virtually every detail of her life for more than 3 decades. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and 2006 USA Memory Champion Joshua Foer. His cover story for National Geographic this month is called Memory: Why We Remember, Why We Forget. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, EP is interesting, but AJ is fascinating. This is a woman who is remarkable not just for the amount of information she can memorize, but for the type. Can you talk about what makes her so unusual?
Sure. AJ is a woman who lives out in California who remembers virtually every day of her life since she was a young girl. It's not that she remembers every detail of every day, but that she has some memory from every day. And when I went out to California to meet her, I brought with me a long list of questions that I thought, you know, there's no way a human being would know all of the answers to all of these questions. You know, what day was Lech Walesa installed in Poland? What was on Murphy Brown on such and such a date? And she knew virtually every answer. I was enormously impressed.
And she has what most of us would consider a pretty normal job, right?
She does, and you would probably not be able to figure out that there was something very, very unusual about her memory just by talking with her until she starts talking about her past or about particular dates in history.
I wonder if that's somewhat lonely for her.
Well, you know, she says actually most of the people she works with have no idea that she has this condition. And she at first assumed everybody was like this. And it sort of only slowly dawned on her that there was something different about her. And then she made contact with these scientists out in California, and they brought her into the lab to study her and were dumbfounded. In fact, they had to coin a whole new term to describe her condition, hyperthymestic syndrome.
And the difference is she doesn't sit down and say, okay, for July 3rd, 2004, I'm going to remember this. It just happens.
Well, that's something of a debate. It's not clear quite what's going on there. There have been some recent imaging done of her brain, which I actually don't know anything about. It hasn't been published yet. But, you know, it's possible that there's something either functionally or anatomically different about her brain. It's also possible that what is unusual about her is not some sort of underlying incredible memory, but rather some sort of underlying incredible obsession with her own past. I mean, if you're a baseball fanatic, you can probably remember huge amounts of otherwise, you know, irrelevant information like batting averages and on-base percentages of players. If you're a chess master, you remember chess games. People remember the things that they are interested in. And AJ clearly has an overwhelming interest in her past and in protecting her past and in preserving it. And she not only has this incredible memory, she actually keeps an enormous number of mementos and documents from her past, including boxes and boxes of videotapes and printouts of the weather from every day of her life. And she just doesn't want to lose any of this past.
Has she been evaluated for things like OCD?
I don't think that was part of her diagnosis. And I'm obviously not a doctor. Mm-hmm. And I can't make that diagnosis. But it seems to me that there is this kind of obsessive interest in protecting her past. Every morning when she's blow-drying her hair, she thinks back on what she did every day of her life on that day. She describes it as like flipping through a Rolodex.
And review does seem to be something that really contributes to our ability to hold on to information in the long term.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the things we remember are the things that we repeat. And so the very act of repeating this every morning, you know, this is what I did on January 4th, 1970, 1971, 1972, certainly reinforces those memories.
So let's talk about you. And this is not included in the National Geographic article, but when you started researching the subject for the book that you're working on for 2009, you decided to try some of this for yourself. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's totally the weirdest thing that ever happened to me. I went to one of these competitions. There are national memory championships held in a dozen countries around the world, and there's one in the United States, which I sort of stumbled upon doing some internet research and thought, oh, that sounds fascinating. You know, Super Bowl of Savants. I'm going to go check that out. And I went and I wrote an article about it for Slate Magazine and didn't know the first thing about this subject at that time. And when I was at this contest, people kept telling me, oh, you know, we actually are not savants. We have just average memories. We just know these techniques invented by Simonides of Chios in the 5th century B.C. That we use to remember huge lists of numbers and people's names and decks of playing cards, the most unbelievable things. That's really interesting. And one of the people at the contest was the second-ranked mnemonist in England, and his name is Ed Cook, and he said, you know, I'd really love to teach you how to do some of this stuff. And I said, sure, that sounds really interesting. And kind of one thing led to another, and the next thing I knew, I was competing in this contest the following year and had actually gotten pretty obsessed with this idea of training my memory.
And what I've read about you says the proverbial 10 minutes a day. Is that actually accurate? That's how much time you spent practicing this?
That is roughly the amount of time I would say on average that I spend practicing every day. But one of the things you have to understand is that the U.S. memory championships are not quite on the same par as, say, the German memory championships or the British memory championships. I went, after having unexpectedly won this U.S. competition, I went to the World Memory Championships as the official representative of the U.S. and got totally waxed by basically every other country, except, I'm happy to say, France. So it's, you know, it's sort of like Americans on the competitive memorization circuit are like Jamaican bobsledders on the Jamaican bobsledding circuit. The most fun, but don't necessarily have, we're behind the curve in terms of technique and training.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Josh Foer. His new piece in National Geographic's November 2007 edition is called Memory, Why We Remember, Why We Forget. Let's talk to Barry in Dallas. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
Good. I read a book recently called by an author by the name of Dr. Nick Lawrence. I don't know him. I just was compelled by the book, and it's called Correlithem Objects. And it talks about how the memory works, how the brain works. And the proposition this high mathematician proposes is that the brain works by looking at objects on hundreds of dimensions, not the two or three dimensions that you and I typically can recognize. And the example he uses is, he says, if you were to envision a table and in a room, and that table was so high and had so many legs and was so big and was what such a color, and it was in a room that had windows or not and had, you know, different attributes, and you were able to plot that on a graph at one point, and then you looked at tables over and over again, all different types, and you plotted them on this same graph, and you would start to see a collection of dots that we would recognize as a table. And and his proposition is that that's how we start to identify different objects and people and places and things and what we do, by looking at them with all these different variables and then creating an average of, okay, well, even though this table is not as high as the last one I saw, and maybe it's got six chairs instead of four, I'm still going to identify that as a table. So I was curious as to whether your research has led you into that kind of thinking and what perceptions you have along those lines.
Oh, great subject. Thank you so much for your call, Barry. That's really interesting.
I have to say, that is some serious philosophy of mine that I think maybe over my pay grade. I don't know quite what to say about that, actually.
You know, what it does bring up for me, Josh, and you talk, I think there's a little bar graph in there that talks about, is it called infant amnesia? The fact that we often don't remember much of anything before we're about 3 years old.
Yeah, isn't that really strange? I mean, I've got a two-year-old nephew who clearly has memories because he remembers the last time I, you know, visited him, and he remembers what I brought him, and yet he will have none of those memories in 10 years. Something happens that causes your memories from early childhood to be erased, and Freud had his own theory about why that happened, and it involved, you know, the mind dealing with the trauma of infancy. Psychologists aren't really sure why it happens. Possibly the hippocampus is somehow not fully enough developed as when you're an infant, but then that raises the question of why, you know, evolutionarily that should be the case. So it's not fully understood why we don't have those memories.
We have an email from Tom in Duncanville who says, I was born in a row house in Baltimore overlooking the railroad. My mom held me up to the window to watch the trains and took me out in the stroller and sat me on the rail of a viaduct to watch the Baltimore and Ohio trains run beneath. We left Baltimore before my first birthday, but to this day I'm wild about the railroad and pursued it as my first career. But I wish I could resurrect memories of the steam engines I must have seen as an infant. Is there any possibility this could happen? Is anybody trying to sort of recapture infant memories?
Not that I know of. I mean, I would say the most likely way that you're going to be able to recapture those memories is to put yourself into the situation that you were in when you initially formed those memories, which is maybe going back to that place and looking at some of these things again. That's how often we're able to sort of make those connections to memories that seem to have been misplaced or lost.
Your article points out the fact that we actually remember far less today than we probably had to before we had what you call external memory, not just the computer, but even things like books.
Sure. If you go back and look at Plato, or Plato writing about Socrates, Socrates says, oh, this invention writing is nothing but bad news. It's going to make us forget how to remember. We're going to become, we're going to rely on writing to remember for us. And, of course, that has come to pass. We don't have to remember lots of things because we have, for example, books or the Internet to remember for us.
Is there any sense that not having to remember certain details frees the mind up to have different kinds of thought patterns?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting question of what the sort of changes in the way that we think are that were caused by this shift towards the externalization of memory, towards using our memories less. I actually sort of believe myself that part of thinking is having lots of things to think about, and that there's a sense in which one wants to have a cluttered brain, you know, in order to create new ideas. And that's actually an idea that goes back to the classical world. In the Middle Ages, you had people writing about the need for having an inventory of thoughts in order to invent new thoughts. And I think that there's something that probably rings true about that.
Josh Fohr is my guest. He's the 2006 USA Memory Champion and the author of a piece for National Geographic's 2007 cover story called Memory, Why We Remember, Why We Forget. Our email address is think@kera.org. Phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Larry in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thank you.
Well, I lived in the Samoan Islands for more than a decade, and I can remember some rather surprising things that I observed in that culture. And they have a person called a high-talking chief. And if there was a meeting and there were a lot of people, different other high-talking chiefs in the meeting, somebody, one of the high-talking chiefs, would go out and announce, like the Book of Genesis, sort of, just announce all the names of these people's ancestors. And some of them can remember 800 years of the family line. And I found that amazing, but even more so, there was an old chief that I was close to, and he announced to his village that he was going to die about a year before he died. And then on that day that he told the folks in his community that he did die. It was just, and that was not something that he was the only one who did it. It's sort of something that happens in Samoa. It's just an amazing thing, and I was wondering where all of that comes from.
I actually didn't know about the oral tradition of the traditions in Samoa, but these sorts of oral traditions exist in pockets all over the world today, and were once, of course, existed everywhere. I mean, Homer was not a writer; Homer was an oral poet, and the Iliad and the Odyssey were delivered from memory. And you can still go to parts of the former Yugoslavia and find epic bards who can recite incredibly long poems from memory, or West African griots who have the same sort of memory of genealogies and tribal histories, and those traditions, of course, disappeared in most of the world with the onset of writing, I think.
What do we know, Josh, about how memories change? Even the ones that we might have for a lifetime, sometimes will be different, you know, at 30 than they are at 60. A detail might somehow seem different. Do scientists have any theories about why things might change?
Well, the more you every time you remember something, you're sort of rejiggering it a little bit. Every time you call up a memory, you're creating an opportunity for that memory to change, and so it's not surprising that memories can mutate over time, and that sometimes we can even remember things that are entirely false, that didn't even happen. Memory, that's just how memory works, and in a way, our memories are like that to protect us. That they're we change things for our own good sometimes.
Yeah, people have talked about, you know, the sort of eternal sunshine of the spotless mind theory, and whether or not it will ever be possible to select something that we just never want to think about again and eliminate that. What do you think, based on the research that you've done so far, do you think that could be possible?
Yeah, I mean, there are drugs out there that that can supposedly do that. Not something I would personally want to experiment with at this point, but I think that is possible precisely because of this idea that when you think about something, you are reactivating that memory. It is therefore theoretically possible that in the act of reactivating it with the right sort of drugs in you, you might be able to erase that memory.
Really makes you think about existence in a different way, because essentially, if you can't remember something, the question as to whether it mattered that it happens to you is sort of left out there.
Yeah, and that's what AJ is so concerned with. If she can't hold on to these memories, what's the point of even, you know, living in the first place?
Was there a little part of you that met her and kind of related to that fear?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, as insane as what, you know, she has sound, there's something, I think, deeply sane about it.
Josh Foer is my guest. He is a writer, and he will be publishing a book on the art and science of memory in 2009. He's got the cover story in this month's National Geographic. We'll return to our conversation with him in just a moment. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Josh Foer is my guest. He wrote the cover story for National Geographic this month. It's called Memory, Why We Remember, Why We Forget. He's also the 2006 USA Memory Champion, and he will be publishing a book on the art and science of memory in 2009. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Shep in Dallas. Hi, Shep.
Good afternoon. This is great. Very interesting. I wanted to ask you, it seems to me the bottom line for memory is that it's things that we have learned to remember. And I was interested if you had any thoughts upon how memory interacts with what we refer to as instinct, whatever that is.
Memory and instinct. Well, you know, E.T. Walking around the block without any sort of understanding of why he's taking the route he does, I think that's what you would call instinct. You know, this training by habit, the things that you know without knowing you know, that's, I think, what instinct is. So we know that that's a different kind of memory from the kind of memory that would be, say, your recollection of baseball statistics.
We have an email from another Josh in Irving, Texas, who says, one attribute of the Myers-Briggs test is sensing, which includes persons who can easily remember details. Does personality affect memory?
Does personality affect memory? Well, I think in this case, we could look at AJ, who is somebody whose personality clearly affects her memory. you know, if she didn't have the sort of interests that she has and the sort of perhaps obsessiveness that she has about them, I don't think she would have quite the memory that she does.
We are talking to Josh Four, who has written the cover story for National Geographic this month. Let's go next to Kelly in Plano. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about, you mentioned the age of three and under that you don't remember anything. And I had a traumatic experience about 2 years old where something very heavy fell on my hand. And they took me to the emergency room. I don't remember any of that. But I do remember my mother and father being on one side of the bed and the doctor being on the right side of the bed. I think he was putting on a cast, et cetera. But years later, I told my mother, I remember part of that. I remember you reciting the book. She had never told me that prior to me telling her that I could remember that. And I was just wondering if trauma has anything to do with memory. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
I mean, that is so interesting. And you do hear that from people, that they have, you know, some traumatic memory from early childhood, or some memory that's even not traumatic, but that which they do remember, despite this other, you know, this other amnesia. But yeah, absolutely, the trauma is a strong factor in making things memorable. Emotion, you know, one interesting study has found that if you just by putting somebody's hand in cold water, which is a traumatic experience, in probably to a lesser degree. Just doing that at the same time as you're asking them to learn something makes that thing more memorable. So when our emotions are increased, so is our memory.
Is there any research whatsoever to try and explain why certain non-traumatic, really, really run-of-the-mill details do stick in our heads and most of the rest of it is washed away?
That is one of the weird things about memory. Sometimes I wonder whether details that I think I remember about, say, my childhood, I wonder whether they are the details as they actually happened or whether they are sort of my own brain filling in the gaps and reconstructing. And it's often hard to tell without actually, you know, finding somebody who was there at the time and asking them.
Well, it's funny, too, because in those instances, sometimes, you know, my sister will remember something clearly that I have no memory of, or vice versa.
Yeah, right. I mean, why would it make an impact on her brain and not on yours? Yeah. It ultimately comes down to what was important to you or to her.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rob in Indianapolis. Hi, Rob.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I had a question about memory and depression. Years ago, I suffered from depression, and my memory was horrible. It almost cost me my job. As soon as I found medication that got me out of depression, my memory improved. So I'm wondering, is it the medication that improved my memory chemically, or the fact that I no longer have mental issues clogging up my mind, you know, taking up all that time and effort and worrying and wringing my hands. Now that the medicine has brought me out of that, is that the reason my memory is better?
This is very common, actually, that depression inhibits memory. And one of the best things that you can do if you're constantly either stressed out or depressed is fix that, and that will, as far as your memory goes, that will improve things.
Did you find, Josh, that when you started practicing for the competition, that without even trying, without even applying a mnemonic device necessarily, that you found that your day-to-day memory sharpened?
No, actually. This is sort of a bit of an open question also. Whether training one's memory in these very specific ways has ancillary benefits, I actually have not really experienced that. What I found is that in the ways that I've trained my memory using these techniques, I can remember lots more things. I can, for example, walk into a room and meet 20 people, and I will have a much greater chance of remembering all 20 of their names than I would have before. But does that impact my memory across the board? Not really. And I think that that's largely because memory is not this single monolithic thing that, you know, there's like a knob that can be turned up or turned down. we have memories for things. We have good memories for different subjects and in different ways. And so it's not the thing that has totally impacted every element of memory in my life.
Is there believed to be a direct link between the facility of one's memory and overall intelligence?
That is a very interesting question also. Oftentimes memory and intelligence get wrapped up with each other. And I think there's a reason that happens, which is people who have good memories for things, for say somebody who has a great memory for Roman history, that person is more likely to be able to learn new things about Roman history, right? They have a web of ideas and facts that they can embed new knowledge in, and there's a way in which having that the larger your web is, the more easy it is for you to learn new things and to make new connections. And so there is, I think, a relationship between memory and intelligence, but probably not necessarily in the way that people often suggest.
So I guess, yeah, the existence of facts that give context to whatever comes in that's new allows you to make those connections.
Well, I was in China recently, and I didn't know, I had an awfully tough time getting around because in all of my education, I'd never really gotten any Chinese history. And I couldn't make heads or tails of anything. I'd go to museums and nothing really, I couldn't really remember what came before what or why I was seeing this or why this was interesting. And of course, that was a function of the fact that I had no background. I had no memories already in my brain of China that could form this network that I could install new ideas and new things in.
You know, it's almost like I had a teacher when I was young that said, when you learn a new word, write it down and try to use it three times that day and then you'll have it. But it's funny that when you hear something new for the first time and you notice it, then you find that it comes up, half a dozen times the next week.
Right. And you wonder, how much were you missing before?
Exactly. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and talk to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question, interesting conversation, by the way. My question has to do with getting away from bad memories. About 15 years ago, I was attacked and woken up in the middle of the night. And every year on the anniversary of that attack, my mind wakes me up at that exact moment, and I sort of relive it. And, the week prior, I won't even think about the event. And I was wondering if, he could speak to that.
Wow, I'm so sorry to hear about that. I think that's something you might be worth talking with a professional psychologist about, just to see sort of what could be done to help get that memory not necessarily cleansed from your brain, but to make it somehow less traumatic when that comes up every year, that time of year comes up. That's what I would recommend.
1-800-933-5372 is the phone number. If you'd like to email us, that is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Flower Mound and talk to Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Fascinating conversation. And following the previous question, my curiosity takes me to post-traumatic stress syndrome. And the little that I do know about it is that an experience generates a memory for most of us. But if you're in that traumatic situation, somehow it gets recorded and re-experienced rather than processed into memory. And there's a psychotherapist technique called EMDR, which is supposed to reprocess the experience that you continue to have and record it then as memory, which is more passive. And I just wanted to find out if Josh had any research or information on that. And I hope you have him back. This is a great conversation.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for your call.
Thanks so much. That's actually, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, not something I know anything about, but it sounds like some information that might be useful to the last caller.
So, Josh, I promised that we'd get back for a little while to Simonides and other people since then that have come up with these mnemonic devices. And I'm wondering if you can talk just a little bit about where you would steer people who think, okay, I want to try this. I want to try and learn to memorize great amounts of information.
Well, there is a huge section in any Barnes & Noble bookstore of self-help books about dealing with memory. Now, most of them, I would say, are tinged by a certain amount of hucksterism or grand claims that they don't really live up to necessarily. But they're all generally conveying the same basic techniques, which were the ones that were invented in ancient Greece. This idea of creating a memory palace, for example, and storing images in your memory palace. Interestingly enough, if you really want to go back to the source, you can pick up the Rhetorica ad Herennium, which was a book published in Rome in the first century BC, I believe. And it, pretty much anything you will find in any contemporary memory self-help book is contained in about a 20-page section of that book. I mean, very, very little has changed in ideas about how to enhance the memory.
How long did it take for you, once you started practicing, to feel like you really were getting good at this?
Well, once you simply learn this technique, this idea of transforming what you want to remember into images and putting them in an imagined architectural space, the memory palace, you can see immediate improvements. You know, all of a sudden I could learn a long list of random words and remember it for days. And that is really a startling thing to realize the first time you try it. And then after that, it's sort of becoming more facile with these techniques. You know, teaching yourself to create images faster, to populate your memory palaces as efficiently as possible. And that's what these people who compete in these contests are doing, is they're really training their brains to remember things as fast as possible and make them those memories as secure as possible.
Is the memory palace a fictional space, or is it like your grandma's house?
It could be either. And if you go back to the very earliest memory treatises written in Rome, you will see that they advise both options. Typically what you're doing is you're taking some sort of space that already exists that you know very well and transforming it maybe in certain ways to make it more memorable. So if it's a church and there are, you know, 20 different pews, well, it's going to be hard to remember 20 pews that all look exactly the same. But if you can transform one of them to make it, you know, really big and one of them to become bright red, then they're differentiated. And so typically you're taking a space that already exists and transforming it.
And what you do ultimately is sort of write a story with whatever this information is.
Yeah, well, that's one way to do things, is to create a story out of whatever it is that you want to remember. The technique I was describing, which is sometimes called the loci method or the journey method, involves actually putting images in different parts of a building and then walking back through that building. And the images might not be connected, but they are connected in the sense that they're all in the same building.
Is it a party trick that you pull out now and then?
Well, the real question is it just a party trick? It certainly can impress people. I mean, one of the things that I was so amazed by is that these are things that the human brain is not supposed to be able to remember. You're not supposed to be able to remember 10 decks of playing cards in perfect order, but it is possible.
Josh Foer is 2006 USA Memory Champion. He wrote the cover story for National Geographic this month. You can pick that up on any newsstand at this point. Look for his book on the art and science of memory to be published in 2009. Josh, it was a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.